Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Welcome to our class today as we start our series, The Loudest Silent Years in History. I'm still in the process of finishing this up with Rabbi Bernstein. We had a few, maybe it's been 6 weeks ago, we had our tour of the temple. And so this is a little temple here, a little model of the temple that's made out of small pieces of olive wood. It was built and made in Bethlehem. There's a gentleman I know who's an Arab Christian. He does a lot of things. This is the smallest one they have. They can make them, you know, huge. Anyway, so we have this here. If you guys want to take a look at it, it has the Holy of Holies and has the bigger aspects of the temple. That being said, so the title, The Loudest Silent Years in History, there's an idea that exists, that's out there, that says that, you know, basically God was mad with his people, the Jews, and at the end of Malachi, you know, he didn't speak for 400 years. So that is out there. The problem with that is, you know, we know about the Maccabees. We know what was done then. We know what was done through Yehudit, we read about last year. And Malachi is not even the last book in the Tanakh, but that's a whole nother story. But what we're going to talk about, we want to fill in some of what was going on in Jerusalem with the people, with the Jewish people, with the Gentiles for that matter too. All right, so as we talk about the loudest silent years in history, one thing we have to recognize. How many of you know that God doesn't just abandon his people for years and doesn't say anything to them, doesn't give them direction, doesn't leave them with anything? How would it be if you had your children and you just, for, you know, X amount of years, you just said, I'm not even going to talk to you. You're my children who I love, but I'm not going to talk to you. I'm not going to communicate with you. You need my help? Well, guess what? I'm not available to talk to. How ridiculous does that sound? That ought to throw up a flag right there that something is not right about that whole idea. When something is not right about a whole idea, what should that make you do? Scratch your head, yes, and say, but then the next step is one of two ways for the most part. Say, well, you know what? If it was important, it would be in there, so forget about it. I'm not even going to look. The other side is, well, ask questions. Why is it not there? And what a wonderful thing is when you're asking a question with someone who knows the answer and they can answer your question, that's great. Well, who has the answer to these questions? The Jewish people? The writings of the rabbis? Me? No, not me. I'm just a small piece of this whole thing. But what I would do, we're going to go through this thing. I'm not going to go through quite as deep as Rabbi Bernstein on some things, because they lead to rabbit trails. But through this, I'm going to give you a nice broad view of what was going on. All right? So in Judaism, prior to the destruction of the temple, you had the temple, right? The temple was destroyed twice. It was destroyed once before Messiah, the first temple, King Solomon's temple. It was rebuilt. It was destroyed, then it was rebuilt later on by, you know, you read the story in Nehemiah when they rebuilt the temple. And then it was destroyed ultimately in AD 70, with that whole after Messiah. But so there were two temples. There'll be another temple or two. That's a whole other story that are coming. But what was Judaism? Anybody who's have a... Someone asked you that, what do you even say? Honey, do you have your microphone that you can... Oh, you do. Anybody have a thought about that? Because this is really important to understand some things in general. Someone says, well, what was Judaism? What is Judaism? Yeah, thank you for asking the question. So we've got a few. Yep, we've got an answer right here.
Living according to the Torah.
Living according to Torah. However, give him the mic back. I'm going to squeeze him for a little more. That's great. After the Torah was given, what was Judaism prior to the Torah being given? The written Torah.
Well, it was oral tradition.
Yeah. And when you say tradition, see, this is where I knew, and this is all good. I'm milking you because I have an idea what you're going to say. So when you say tradition to someone, typically they get this idea of something man-made or that's just how we do things. Was that the case? Or was it something that was either God-inspired, God-led? Yeah, Casey? Yeah.
Well, I mean, isn't it man-made how we do this? That's kind of the definition of what it is. It's the interpretation of how to do things.
But that's not man-made. Well, it's not man-made alone. It's man-made with the man who had the mandate to make how we do things. Apart from man just doing something, like I could come up today and say, okay, we have this new thing we're doing and call it whatever you want to call it, that has nothing to do with Judaism, nothing to do with God, because I don't have the authority to make what's referred to as halakha. Yes.
Okay, but when God created Adam,
yeah,
didn't he download all the information that he would need?
Well, that's,
and that was transmitted then verbally?
It was. And that, hold on to that though. That's true, but that's not quite. He's talking about a man. Go ahead.
So, what was the interpretation if Torah hadn't been given yet?
So, the interpretation of Torah having been given is connected to the idea that Torah always existed. It existed before the foundation of the world. And remember, we got to look at these things outside of time and space. So, it existed. It was there. Yes.
So, Adam would have known future things.
He would have, yeah. Well, he would, yes, yes.
Because he wouldn't have been alive for everything.
No, right, so he would have known a lot of things that we don't know, and a lot of things that he knew were passed on, but then a lot of things that he knew were also lost, too. So all of that, we're going to come across another passage in Torah today, then I'm going to pause for a second and say, where did this come from? How did this person know how to do this? And you're going to scratch your heads. And you're going to have to say oral law. And I like using the word law, oral instruction, tradition. From a outside looking in, tradition is a very loaded word that can really mean something that is not. Because tradition, really from a Jewish standpoint, is broken down into two main things. Halakha, or what was decided by the leaders of Israel, how do we do things? Remember, they decided to, for temple service, Yeshua comes along. I'm sorry, they decided to have synagogues. This was man decided that. This, the Anshei Knesset HaGadol, we'll talk about that in a few lessons. Yeshua comes around, and where was he going? He was going to the temple. He was also going from synagogue to synagogue to teach, and we'll see that today in Luke. So Yeshua didn't take this quote-unquote man-made thing and destroy it or say, oh, no, 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 no. In fact, it was Yeshua along, with the Father who gave that instruction to, or put it on the hearts, for lack of a better way of saying it, to the men of the great assembly to decide what to do. But ultimately, who decided what to do? They decided what to do. So if you say it was just tradition, a tradition of man, well, no. Because then you have Yeshua following something else, a tradition of man that was separate from him. No, it was together. This is Judaism. It's this. It's God and it's man together. It's not separate, but you can have things that are separate. You can have someone making a decision and calling it halakha, or the way we should do things, but it's not with the nation. It's not with the entire. So then it's not. There's also from synagogue to synagogue, you have what are called minhag, M-I-N-H-A-G. Minhag is a tradition that you can do, like a tradition we have the Matzovu playing when we come in, and it's a particular version of the Matzovu which is very unique. That's a minhag for us. So what's the difference between the two? Well, a minhag or a custom or a tradition is okay as long as it doesn't go against halakha. That makes sense? So you can have a tradition within the synagogue of doing something, as long as it doesn't go against what with all of Israel does, then it's okay. We have a tradition that we may start, Well, we have a tradition about someone answers questions and they get to go first in the line at Onig. That's a tradition. Does that go against Halakha? No. But that's a minhag of our congregation. So these are all things. In general, I want you to just see these, the differentiation between some of these things. That being said, let's get back to what we're talking about here, the temple. So prior to Yeshua, these years we want to talk about are the years between the destruction of the first temple and roughly the time of Yeshua. Okay? That's the time frame we're looking at. Because again, you're looking at the temple was destroyed, and then all of a sudden, the next words you hear in the Brit Hadashah, you hear the words of Matthew talking about Yeshua. So that's roughly where we're going to talk about. Any thoughts, questions? No? Right, good on that? Yeah. Yeah. No? Maybe? Yes? No, maybe?
Well, one definition of the oral law is a legal commentary explaining how to carry out the commandment.
How to carry, right. And that's, and I'm glad you said how you said it. One definition of. So that is not the definition of, the only definition of, the only part, but that's a big part of it. And we'll get into that more and more, but yeah.
What do you mean that's not the only part of it?
That's one part of it. That's one part, the legal understanding of how to do a halakha. How do we do it together? God said to, he told, you know, Bezalel to build the ark. Well, how did he do it? Well, the Lord led him in that. He didn't give him specific instruction. And so that understanding of how to do things, how to build the temple was passed down, but it wasn't written down very specifically. Then you have things that were like the tallits, the, you know, a tallit with the fringes or the tzitzit. Well, that's been passed down orally because that wasn't specifically given either. So I don't want to get quite into that because that's taking us off of where we want to get to today. But that's it'll come up in bits and pieces. So Judaism was and always is temple-centered. Today there's no temple. It's still temple-centered in that things that are done represent what we can do without a temple. We'll get into that later on. That gets into liturgy. So the idea is that in Judaism, the people, for thousands of years, they had a temple. Hundreds of years, they had a temple. They had the tabernacle in the wilderness, which is basically a temporary temple, in effect. And they would live around it. Their whole lives are based on the temple, the temple, the temple. What was done in the temple? Sacrifices were done in the temple daily. Many of them. We want to talk about that. We want to talk about the temple service. So the temple service began in the morning, and you at what's referred to sunrise, Hashahar, which you get this word, Shacharit, which are the morning prayers. Okay, so that's how the temple, and it starts at sunrise. So was it at a specific time of day where you can set your, look at your watch, look at your sundial and see what time to get there? No. Sunrise. That was when it started. And you started with a day couldn't even start in the temple without the first offering, which is referred to as the Tamid offering. Anybody know what Tamid refers to? This is one to remember and write down because when you're talking to people who say to you, oh, well, you know, we don't need that anymore. Say, well, let me ask you something. How did the temple service start? They have no idea. What was the first offering of the day? They have no idea. When was it? They may have an idea. It's a Tamid offering. What does Tamid mean? It means forever or everlasting. So we don't need to do this anymore. Okay, well, what did Messiah, what did, you know, the Father say mean when he called this Tamid? Forever and everlasting if we don't need it anymore. First thing you need to understand about the temple, about the Tamid offering. Yes.
Do you say an offering or a prayer?
Offering. Offering. Oh. But at the time, Hashahar, at sunrise, you had the Shacharit off. The prayers are going up too. Next week, we'll talk about the Shacharit prayers. That'll be our liturgy. Next week, we'll talk about, yes.
So what was that sacrifice for?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. That's the next thing I was going to say. So when someone says to you, oh, well, we don't need all that stuff anymore because why don't we need it anymore? Because Jesus came and he's the final sacrifice for our sins. Anybody ever heard that or thought that? What was the tamid offering for in the morning? Was it for sins? No. All the offerings weren't for sins. And it started with the morning offering, the tamid offering. During the service or during the temple service that day, there were, and you can imagine priests everywhere, they're singing, they're doing things, they're moving to and fro and all. Everyone had a job to do and they were doing it. If you can imagine the temple, I always grew up, we grew up in the country, we have ant hills and there are always ants coming in and out and there were beehives and there were bees coming in and out. And I remember when I was in grade school at some point, the teacher, the beginning of the year, we put together an ant farm. And we did it, if I remember right, we did it on a Friday. And we brought the queen ant and put it in with the ants, and it was just the sand and everything. And teacher said, you know, okay, we'll see you guys on Monday. And by the time we came back on Monday, some work had been done. I mean, there were ants moving here and moving there. They had little tunnels and all kinds of stuff going on. And all the ants knew what to do. The whole ant society, everybody knew what to do and they were doing it and they all depended on one another. And we came back to tunnels and all these things. And I remember it went off at me like, wow, that's amazing. Then I remember as a kid going to the fair. And at the fair, they would have a beehive. But they made this beehive as a display where it had a plexiglass side on it so you can see into the inner workings of the beehive. It's amazing. You had these big old bees, the drones doing these certain things, and you had the workers going out and flying and back. You had the queen protected. You had the area where they moved the dead to deal with. You had the area where they had the nursery where the babies were. You had the food storage area. I mean, it was like Egypt. You know, they stored all the food, the honey in a certain area, and you thought, whoa, look at that. You can imagine the temple. The priests all had a job to do, and they did it, and nobody stepped out of line. You didn't have some, you know, Levite decide, oh, I'm going to go and walk in and hang out in the Holy of Holies. You didn't have this kind of nonsense. Everybody knew, and there was a code of understanding that you adhered to, which they did. And so the Judaism, everything about Judaism was temple-focused, sacrifice-focused, that the offering started in the morning. You had two tamid offerings. You had one at sunrise, and you had one before sunset. And they had to be done. Every offering that would come in between would have to be done in between those two. So this time of year, today is December, say the 18th, 17th. So the 21st, are coming up in a couple days. So even on these shorter days, they still had to squeeze in all the work they would do on what we would refer to as June 21st, the longest day of the year, they'd squeeze in there to do. In between, yes.
Well, wouldn't they not have had to do any squeezing because of time?
Well, that's a good point. Would they not have to do any squeezing because of being outside of time and space? Yeah, absolutely. See? So you're bringing up things that are a deeper level than what I was teaching on, but yeah, they didn't. So in essence, they could have had, if the temple were located, say, at the North Pole, then what? And this is very, I'm just throwing this out there kind of thing. And, you know, or a little further south where you only had, maybe during the winter, you had maybe an hour of daylight. Could they have gotten it done in those circumstances too with everything we know about the temple? Yes. Could they have gotten it done on the equator? Yes. But the whole idea was between these two end pieces, the tamid offerings, everything I'd done. So what was the tamid offering? Remember, it means forever, everlasting. They'd take a lamb, and the lamb would be burnt. So they put the lamb, they'd offer it, put it on the altar, and it would burn to a crisp. This is one of the few offerings that wasn't made for food for the priests or the people. Then in the evening, there was another tamid offering. And they would have to get it on there before sundown, and it would burn basically all night. It would cook. In between, I want to talk about a few things. So here are some of the offerings that could have taken place. Again, this offering was not connected to sin. This was referred to as a hukah. Why is it done? Because God said to do it, and so that's why it's done. This is why when people say things about Messiah and they try and connect him to everything and they don't recognize what they're saying, and when I talk about this kind of thing, I feel really, really sad for people who don't want to listen and understand. A friend of mine was talking to about a particular issue. The person told him, oh, well, it doesn't say that in the King James Bible, so what you're saying is not true. So, okay, well. And you meet people like that who just don't know, and they reading another article, another friend, they were working with someone who used to be an evangelical pastor. Then they became a Noahide. Now they're converting to Judaism. When people want to hear, if they're not led right, they'll just go off into things that are good, but they're doing it for the wrong reasons and missing so much. So the offerings in between. On Shabbat, you would have, well, let me go back a little bit here. Let's see. How do we have this here? Yeah. So on Shabbat, you have different offerings that are added that aren't added on, that don't go on during the week, Shabbat, and also the Moedim, the holy days. Remember, Casey talked about the Passover in particular, where there's a whole bunch of things going on that weren't going on a regular day. But these additional offerings were called Musaf, M-U-S-A-F, which in Hebrew means, that's just what it means, additional. And you're going to see these words come up in the liturgy and wonder why. What does that even mean? Well, this is why. So Musaf is additional. Tamid is forever, everlasting. So these additional offerings on Shabbat, on one of the Moedim, the holy days, are offered by the Kohens in the temple. So again, these additional offerings for Shabbat consisted of two lambs. And again, let me say this, they weren't connected to sin. These two lambs weren't burned, they were actually eaten by the Kohen. Then you'd also have another offering every month on Rosh Chodesh. Anybody know what Rosh Chodesh is? The new moon, the new moon. Shabbat Shalom. Again, is this connected to sin? Not connected to sin either. So you may ask, what if they fell on the same day? If you had a Rosh Chodesh, you had Shabbat, then basically what you would do, all three would take place. The Tamid offering again would always start. The Shabbat offering would go next, and the new moon or the Rosh Chodesh offering would be offered as well. These Musaf offerings would be stewed or roasted. So again, you can see this. This is for food for the Kohens as well. You know, so you may have some that was roasted or like braised, some braised lamb that would be cooking, or some roasted, you know, rack of lamb kind of thing. You get this idea. And the smell would be throughout Jerusalem. You could smell it. You can see it in the temple courts. You could look up and you can see things that you couldn't see outside, et cetera, et cetera. And these were given to the Kohen as food. Hallelujah. So then you come up to a holiday like Yom Teruah in Scripture, or what's referred to as Rosh Hashanah. And you would have offerings that were for the entire nation of Israel and individual offerings. So let's talk about some individual offerings that would take place. You would have what's referred to as the Shlamim offering or a peace offering. If you had there were peace offerings not connected to sin. You had an offering called an asham. On the peace offering is shlamim, S-H-L-A-M-I-M, shlamim. And then you would have, there's an offering called an asham, A-S-H-A-M. And this is an offering for sin, but this is an offering for an accidental sin. Say you were just living your life going along and you found out that you committed a sin you didn't even know about. Right. You didn't do it intentionally. You found out, you know. And so what do? You know, you didn't realize you were somewhere and you accidentally stole something from someone, you know. You know, you go somewhere, you know, it's something really minor, say, you know, you're at work. And it's lunchtime, and you go in the office fridge, and you know, oh, wow, there's a piece of cake from last week. Or there's a donut sitting in there, you know. Oh, wow, it's the last donut that we had. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and eat it. Well, you find out later on, it's the last donut for Hanukkah. But you find out that donut's the rightful owner had given it to someone else and just set it in the fridge for him. And this is a simple. And you basically, in effect, you stole it, right? And you can think of a whole host of things. You just accidentally, something happened. Oh, I can't believe I did. I didn't mean to do that. You know, we were in Yosemite some years back. And I'm not going to say any names. And one of my uncles was there and one of my cousins. It was just one of those days. You know, you don't always get along with your kids real good. Things happen. I don't know what happened. I just walked up on the scene, and my poor uncle was pleading his case with one of his children. And there was a lot of this going on. Hey, wait, wait a minute, let me explain. Something happened, I don't know what. And the person wasn't hearing it. They were just tuning it out. He was trying to explain his case. And it was that kind of idea. You're like, oh, God, I didn't mean this, but wait, let me explain what happened. Or you're doing that to people. Hey, let me explain, I didn't mean to do that, but I sinned. So what do? I go to the temple and bring an asham offering. Asham means guilt offering. Sometimes you may, if you were going to go into a Nazirite vow, but what do you have to do? You've got to bring an offering to start and to end that. And again, was that the offering for the Nazirite vow? Was that something, an offering for sin? No, that same kind of thing. So again, there's always, after the Tamid offering, there was the Shabbat offering, the Me'od offering, and then after that, you know, there's a lot of people lined up waiting to bring their offerings in. Then the individual offerings come in. What does that tell you? The priority was always for the nation. You know, your priority is your family, and then the individuals within the family. Your priority is your community, then the individuals within the community. Israel's entire existence was based on temple service, temple sacrifices, temple the offerings. But that would work if you were there. What if you weren't there? Well, for those who weren't there, they were called to come three times a year, right? If you could. But say you were even further away where you couldn't even make it three times a year. This would cause some problems. And we're going to talk more about that. If you guys have any questions, just raise your hand as we go through here. So the temple, all of these offerings, there's thousands of them or tens of thousands, just depending on what was going on, maybe hundreds of thousands. And they come up to the final offering of the day, the Tamid offering. They put the lamb on. He's going to roast all night. Does that mean that everything is done for the day? No. Go ahead, Casey.
You said the communal sacrifices, was that for everyone who was On the temple or everyone who was in the land?
For the whole nation.
Okay.
The whole nation of Israel. Who was the whole nation of Israel? All the Jewish people. Yeah.
But you said if people weren't in the land,
yeah,
then that would cause problems.
So yeah, it would cause problems because if you weren't around the temple to see everything going on every day, do you think you could have a connection to God through the temple, through the offerings and the workings of the temple if you lived 500 miles away compared to somebody who lived right there and was part of it every day? It would be different. Yeah.
So are people who live across the globe, are they still covered by that?
Yeah, absolutely. They're okay. Still Israel. They're still Kolam Israel, wherever they were.
Okay. Yeah. I thought you were saying that you had to be
no, you
in
didn't have
the to. Land.
No, what I'm, so let me rephrase my, make my point clear. Judaism is centered around the temple service, the offerings, all of that. If you weren't around that every day, that could cause some problems. You think about bringing to you like this, something closer to us. Our, you know, if you look at the perfect situation that your life is centered around our local synagogue, our local Messianic synagogue, that you come to Shabbat to Shabbat. Well, what if you lived a long ways away? You would see you would lose some of the connection to the congregation here, right? Well, you can imagine those who live far away from the temple, the connection that they would lose. And so the end of the temple day has come. We're going to talk more about that in later. Yes.
Why were people so far away?
Another good question. Because Jews lived everywhere, especially prior to the destruction. They were everywhere. This is why people think that, you know, when you see Paul and different ones going out, that these were churches. No, there were Jews. The Jews are all over the place. And so there were Jews who coming on Messiah. They were coming together, and also Gentiles were coming together with them, and they were starting communities within the communities that were Messianic and not, a place for Messianics to come to as well. Go ahead. Yeah, if you have a, yeah.
The Jewish people were given different territories for tribes to live in. So the tribes would be maybe in northern area of Israel, could be way south.
Right.
And they would be able to come on a regular basis except for the feast times.
Right, that's true, but also more to it than that is when you were talking about Jews in Turkey and, in Europe and Africa, Egypt, all throughout all that area, yeah.
Did they disperse more once the temple was destroyed?
We'll talk about that. Okay. These are all good questions we're going to get to. What I want to get to today is the temple. The center is the temple. Yeah.
At the very beginning, when you began talking about the Tamid sacrifices, mm-hmm. you asked what it was for, but you never answered the question.
Oh, it's a hukah. It's for because God said to do it. And if he says to do it, so why is it done then? If it's not done for something personal like forgiveness, or then why is it done? Well, because God said to do it, so we're going to do it. And the bookends of all the sacrifices were the two Tamid offerings, because God said to do it in the morning, we're going to do it in the morning. God said to do it at night, we're going to do it at night.
So there isn't any deeper meaning behind that?
I'm sure there is to some point, but that's not the point. The whole point of it is God said to do it, so it's done. That's why it's called a chok or hukah. God said to do it, so we do it. There's a lot of things within between that there's very specific meanings to. But if you're not going to do what God said to do first without understanding, then you'll never do what God said to do just because you understand it. And we see that when they came to Sinai. Remember what they said? Remember they said, we will do because you said to do it, and then we'll understand it later on. So that's that whole principle of we're going to do because you said to do it. And even after that, there are things we understand that we'll do. And some of the things that we don't understand that we do, that you told us to do, we're going to do regardless if we ever have any understanding or not.
How do you spell hukad?
C-H-U-K. What you can do, C-H-O-K is hok, which is something that's God says to do, but doesn't give an explanation. Like the red heifer, that's a real big one. Hukah is basically the same kind of understanding. It's from the same root. Something that's said, God said to do, and with no explanation. Hukat is a specific thing God says to do without explanation, yes.
When you say without explanation, are we talking about something where he gives it to someone to interpret, or there's just no explanation?
There's no explanation.
So it wasn't a situation where they decided how to do it.
It was a situation where they decided how to do it in that they brought the offering and burned it all up. And I'm sure there were some specific things that they would do, which maybe we'll read about in the Talmud. It gives the specific ideas, but their part was to actually do it. They could stew it. Well, I take that back. This one was burned up. This one was totally burned up. Later on, offerings, they could stew. It was basically cooked. But that's the whole point. The whole point of it is God said to do it, we're going to do it.
So if you were to ask one of the priests, let's say they'd just say, because God said to do it.
Yeah. Okay. Why do we do it? God said to do it. You can look at some things that aren't a chok and ask the same kind of questions. Okay, well, God said to come on Shabbat and, on Shabbat to rest. Why? You can come up with some reasons, but those reasons don't trump, doing it because he said to do it. So this is the whole thing, is that if he said to do it, regardless if we understand or not. And then some things, it's almost like God is saying, you're going to do this, and I'm never going to tell you why. You going to trust me to do it or not? That's it. And humanity has been plagued by this idea from when we're children. As a parent, what is the one thing we never want to hear from our children when we ask them to do something? Why? Try that way your boss. Your boss asks you to do a simple thing. Why? Remember, we talk about relationships all the time. Relationships with one another, relationships between us and God. Why? And when parents finally get tired and they're done, what do they say? Because I said so. What does that mean? Recognize authority. Submit to authority. Listen. Did God ask you to do something that you couldn't do? No. He asked you for a simple thing. One lamb in the morning, one lamb in the evening. Do that. All the blessings I've given to you, and that the all of the covenants I've given to you. Here's part of the covenant. If I ask you to do something, say yes and do it. Yeah.
I believe all the symbols and the signals, they all come together, right? Because at the time when the Egyptians, they said, hey, we're going to mark a red. We're going to put a red.
Oh, and Passover?
Yeah,
and God said, right, God said to do it. They could have waited to try and figure out exactly why. And back then, there were different things going on, because back then, there still existed personal altars. So, but it's the same kind of idea. God said, bring an offering, and you're either going to say yes or no. Why? Not a good answer. Not a good answer. Last one, and I got to keep going, or we're not going to get finished this today.
So he didn't say why, or we don't know why?
He didn't say why specifically. That's why it's called a chok. When we get to Parashat, it talks about hukat. It's very specific. Do this because I said so. That's it. Don't eat. You can eat of all these trees, but don't eat from that one tree. Why, God? Why? Because I said so. Yeah.
So it's in Leviticus, one of the 613?
Which one are you talking about?
And for the Tamid.
Oh, for the Tamid. Very specifically, if you read through, this is in, the specifics are in the Talmud in Tractate Tamid. Would you guys want to read that next time we come together? I'll bring in, we can read it all. That'd probably be a good way of,
solidifying. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's, but as far as for reading just in general about the, if you read in Numbers chapter 28 and 29, this is the temple service. Well, Numbers 28 and 29 is the temple service from the standpoint of the people. Leviticus 23 are the holidays, the holy days, the Chagim, relative to the temple and the temple service. You're talking about Passover.
No.
You're talking about Leviticus chapter... Yeah, but that, yeah. Right, so that's not, yeah. That's part of it, but that's not the whole thing. So if you want to read, again, Numbers 28, 29, Leviticus 23, and Tractate Tamid, which, you know what, next month we'll read it. I'll bring in, we'll read it together, yeah.
So is that one of the 613?
Which one? Is which one of them?
The command to do the offering.
To do the offering? Yeah, it would have to be. I don't know if it's a, yeah, it should be a specific one, but right, I'm not sure, but it's a command of God. I don't know how specific it is for that particular offering. That's a good question. It's been a long time since I've gone through those. I don't remember exactly. But again, it's the commands to present the offerings all through Numbers 28, 29, Leviticus 23 is all through there, a bunch of them. All right, so we've gotten to the point where we're talking about the end of the day. All these offerings have been going on. It's starting to get dark. Is that the end for the priests that day? No. So there's a term I want to give you guys. That the term is Mizbeach, like M-I-Z-B-E-A-C-H, Mizbeach. M-I-Z-B-E-A-C-H, but it's not Ms. Beach. Mizbeach. And I could be translating or transliterating this different than, but the Hebrew, Mizbeach, okay? And what is the Mizbeach? Casey, you said? The Mizbeach is the offering when you go to the beach. No. Good try, though. So the Mizbeach is the Hebrew word for the altar. So you can imagine... in a day, hundreds or thousands of animals have been slaughtered. There's blood and guts and different things. There's grain that has been roasting, and the grain would be sprinkled on the altar. Some would be given for the Kohen to eat. Anybody ever work in a restaurant? And the end of the shift, dinner service is done, everybody wants to go home, and man, it's dirty. Clean up, oh my gosh. Can you imagine a butcher shop with thousands of animals that go through? Imagine how much blood and guts that are there. And remember we talked about the rabbi said that the smell, miraculously, you wouldn't smell it. It never, the smell of it never caused a woman to miscarry. There were things in the temple. This is the nexus between heaven and earth that operated outside of time and space. A lot of cleanup had to be done. So cleanup went on. That had to be done. And it had to be done in time for what? Tomorrow, sunrise, the next Mizbeach, or I'm sorry, the next Tamid offering on the Mizbeach. It kept on going. This is like a post office. You know, there's an episode, yeah.
Like an aircraft carrier with three ships.
An aircraft carrier with three ships. Exactly, exactly. There was an old episode of Seinfeld. I don't know if you guys ever watched that. But the mailman Newman... he has this little rant. You know, he's a mailman. He's, you know, it never stops. He's come. He's going, it never stops. The mail. Oh, and he's just going nuts. And, you know, so they have this term you hear in society called going postal. you know, you just go crazy. I mean, it never stops. This stuff coming and going and coming and going. You used to work in the back of the post office, sorting mail and just stuff. You got to move as quickly as you can. Our mail carrier right now, when we see here, they're swamped. I mean, there are Amazon packages like you wouldn't believe. They can't keep up. So it's time for cleanup at the temple. How is it that you got?
I have a question.
Oh, yeah. Hang on one sec. How is it that this perfect place, this nexus between heaven and earth, had all of this death and all of this mess that needed to be cleaned up? That almost doesn't sound like it goes together, does it? But it does.
Those places where they do this cows.
Like the slaughterhouses?
Yeah,
that's basically what it was. Yeah. I see. You know one animal how it smells. If you ever butcher a big animal or a small one for that matter, you can imagine thousands of them. Hang on one second, I'm gonna get to you. Go ahead, because you had your hand up.
Okay. What is the definition or the meaning of Mizbeach again?
Altar. The altar.
Hebrew word
for altar.
Okay, because that's in our Hanukkah song today.
Mizbeach. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have to look at that and see the context of it, but yeah.
About the Hanukkah altar.
Oh, the Hanukkah altar, yeah. Yeah. So this is the first. I want to get through this first lesson. Go ahead. I know you had your hand up.
Luis, have you driven through Los Banos?
Yeah.
There's a slaughterhouse right on the main drag, but they use the French word abattoir.
Oh, yeah, that's so that we can get the meat at right there, yeah? You know, have you stopped there? Really? We've driven through, never stopped there.
It's not cheap.
Okay, but it's probably good quality meat and everything, and yeah.
And sometimes it doesn't smell so good.
Yeah. We had a gentleman who, in another congregation, who worked at a local plant, and he was in charge of, you know, he was right there in the dispatching portion of the process. And, you know, you just start seeing life is precious. It just, you know, 1 minute there, next minute gone. A day later, you know, hamburger on someone's plate. And that's, and God ordained. You know, we talk about part of, you know, kashrut or things that are kosher, is that how was the animal treated? And, you know, miraculously, when they decided how to dispatch the animal, that was, you know, science has proven out that's the most pain-free way just to go out. So God is always behind things and showing people things. And Judaism is a, it's, you don't find vegetarians amongst the Levites. They weren't just eating the grain. And they got the best cuts of the meat too. Yeah, go ahead.
Was the part about no blood, was that why they sacrifice it that way, or is the no blood because they sacrifice it that way?
It's because they cut the artery. And the blood is, the heart is still pumping.
Okay.
But so the animal quickly just goes unconscious, really.
So if there was blood, that means it wasn't sacrificed correctly.
It wasn't dispatched correctly. Yeah, I mean, basically they would let the blood drain out. Yeah. And the idea of this too, so people can take these kind of things to extremes. The idea was, you know, you would dispatch it, cut it, let its blood pump out. Was there still a little blood somewhere? Yeah. I mean, you can't eat anything without meat, without having some sort of, that's not the idea. When you went through this process, you got, there's so little that it, you know, even within the rabbis teach that, you know, as far as for something being kosher or not, I believe their percentage is it 1/60? I think it's 1/60 of something. If it's not kosher, if it's less than 1/60, then it's okay. On the other hand, you have, you know, when they would be so picky, they would strain out a gnat from their soup. But then there, when you have the other side of this idea of swallowing a camel, eating a whole big, you know, eating a camel, that's totally not kosher. So there's this idea of, in Judaism, if you ever want to just have something on lockdown where that's it, end of discussion, there are very few things like that. And even things like that, people still discuss. So let me go through this. I've got one half a page left. So then the last tamid offering that's put on the mizbeach and the altar, it roasts all night. There are special ways to do so. The fire must not go out, including on Shabbat. So then how could they have this fire on Shabbat? Doesn't that break the Shabbat rule about fire? What is the Shabbat rule about fire? You must not do what? Kindle. So you don't start a new fire on Shabbat, but an existing fire you could use on Shabbat. In, again, in Talmud, Tractate Tamid, we'll bring it in, and next month we'll read that, and we'll dig into this a little more, because this is just the basis that we'll continue to build upon. So being temple-centered, offering-centered, as a Jew, it caused a lot of problems too. And we're going to pause right there, because I can't get into the problems it caused without. Anybody have any last thoughts?
For the sin offers will be who will assign which animal will be sacrificed for that?
The people would, based on what sin it was. So there were certain sins that we may get to some too, and it depended on how much money you had. So, you know, if you were poor, you could bring something less than if you were rich. But there were certain sins where someone had an idea what you did wrong. Or if you were just coming in, you can bring a sin or an offering called like a todah offering. Something good happened and you were thanking God by bringing something in. Was different than you brought in an offering for if you were getting in and out a Nazirite vow, or if you had sinned, or if you were a woman who was impure and you're coming into. So everybody by the offering often told people what was going on, what you were. But everyone did it, so it wasn't like it was some big old deal, because you know what? You can sit there, ooh, look at that offering. They did something wrong. And the next day, you could be the one bringing the same thing. And remember this too, before you'd go to the offering, to the temple, you know, you would go and you would mikvah, you would clean yourself, you know, bathing, right? But you would also clean yourself spiritually by going to a mikvah, because you were spiritually unclean and you wanted to come out in a position of being spiritually clean to go to the temple. And when you did that, you were with men, the women, they had their own mikvah, but when they did it, everyone was naked. So what was that idea? You couldn't just hide things. And everyone's looking at you with the idea of, you know what? I mean, I don't see anything I don't see in me from natural to even a position of sin. You know, I'm subject to the same type of things that you're subject to. So why look at me all funny when I saw you last week up there with the same offering? You know? Any last thoughts? You guys enjoying this?
Imaginations.
What's that?
Imaginations.
Oh, imaginations. Yeah, you know. Yeah, but and that's the thing. You think about our culture and society now looking at that. It's totally different than, I mean, the synagogue right up here. I'm sure they have a mikvah there, a men's and a women's mikvah. So the people within that synagogue, there's no, it's just a different experience. So, yeah, any last thoughts? We'll pick this up in January on the week 3, Judaism and Hebrew 101.